Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. What's for dinner tonight? First, you have to decide what to cook, then how to cook it, and that's the trick for most of us, the how part. Joining us this hour to talk about that is New York Times Curious Cook columnist Harold McGee. We're going to talk especially about his book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Welcome to the show, Harold.
Good morning, Ann.
I read in another interview that you were inspired by Strunk and White's Elements of Style in how you put this book together. How so?
Well, I started out life many years ago as an English major, and Strunk and White is this wonderful, very concise manual for writing good English. And I was hoping to do something of the sort for cooking, just make it as concise and straightforward as possible. The Elements of Style is maybe 150 pages long, and that's what I was shooting for. It turned out that cooking is more complicated in some ways than writing, or at least there are many more things to keep an eye on, and so I ended up a little over 150.
About 500, I counted, about 524 pages, not counting the index and the acknowledgments at the end.
That's right.
And it still, as I paged through it and was reading it, it still covers cooking basics like you wanted, not necessarily any advanced techniques or super fine points.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to put down the basics, the kinds of things that recipes often don't bother to tell you because the writers will often assume that you already know it, or they may assume that they know that this is the best way to do things when, in fact, there are other ways to do the same thing and sometimes better ways.
You know, in the olden days, you know, I'd actually go to the dictionary sometimes and just look up words from recipes because I didn't know. Now there's the internet, but the beauty of this book is that is the way you organize it, and you actually put the chapter listings on the. I know it's on the front cover of the paper cover.
That's right. Because the idea for this was that it'd be kind of the opposite of our standard cookbooks these days, which are often, they have beautiful graphics, you know, gorgeous close-up color photographs that really may inspire you to make something, but don't really tell you how to get there. And so I wanted this to be as functional as possible, and putting the chapter titles on the front cover was part of that. I actually wanted to go a step further and put the page numbers on the front cover, but the publisher drew the line at that.
A point you made, and I think it's in the introduction, that really struck me. It really hit me because I feel this way every single year, was that every Thanksgiving rolls around and most of us haven't roasted a turkey since the last Thanksgiving. So really many of us have only roasted a few turkeys in our lives, yet it's supposed to be one of these big fabulous meals every year.
That's right. People who write cookbooks do it generally for a living, and so they're cooking every day and they get all kinds of kind of knowledge built into their fingertips about how things work. And the rest of us are cooking, you know, maybe a few times a week, maybe only on weekends, really, do we have time to really make a relatively complicated meal. And then when it comes to holiday feasts, we generally only do those on holidays, and they come around once a year. So, again, that to me was cause to try to put together a book that would help people refresh their memories and fill in the gaps when we're making things that we don't make all that often.
My guest is Harold McGee, New York Times columnist and author of Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. I did flip through it looking for recipes at first, not aware that you were not specifically going to put recipes in, but weren't you tempted to throw in a few?
Yeah, and in a way, there are some that they don't look like recipes, but they're a description that's close enough to give you one. Again, my feeling was that we have so many recipes in the world that, in a way, the last thing we need is another set of them. And so the kinds of passages in the book that come close to being recipes are just procedures that are so basic and so straightforward that I can describe them in a sentence. And you don't
like
really
a scrambled egg or something like that.
Yeah. And you don't need a list of quantities and that kind of thing.
What are some of the most common questions you have been getting?
Uh, uh, I would say that most of them have to do with cooking meat. And that makes sense because meat is the meat and fish and eggs, the protein-rich foods are the ones that are the trickiest to get just right. Starchy vegetables and things like that are pretty straightforward to cook, but the texture, especially the consistency of a piece of meat or fish, depends almost exclusively on the temperature that you cook it to, and that's a tricky thing to get right. It's kind of amazing that in this day and age we don't have a machine that we can put something into and just have it come right to that temperature and be done with it. But for the moment, we have to kind of nudge things along in that direction and try to get it as close as possible.
One of the myths that you dispel that I saw repeated in a lot of the reviews and in the book, of course, too, is the idea that you have to sear the meat before, you know, to hold in the juices.
That's right. And, you know, that turns out to be not an old cook's tale, which you might think, but an old chemist's tale, a scientist's tale, a guy in the 19th century who thought he knew enough chemistry to predict how things were going to behave when you cook them. But cooking turns out to be, I would say, the most complicated kind of chemistry out there. And it turns out that searing a piece of meat, cooking it at a really high temperature to begin with, does give you a really nice brown crust. But it doesn't do anything to seal the juices in. And the juiciness of a piece of meat or fish depends completely on the temperature that you cook the inside to.
What about that recipe for, like, filet mignon where you sear it on the outside, you pan sear it, and then you pop it in the oven and bake it? Isn't that what that's for?
Well, that's actually a wonderful technique. You can use it with all kinds of meats and fish. But it really is, in a way, the opposite of what Liebig, this chemist, was talking about. Uh-huh. Because what it does is give you the contact with the hot pan on the stovetop, which does give you the nice brown crust on the outside. Mm-hmm. But then instead of trying to continue to cook it through on that heat, what you do is you take the pan and stick it in the oven, where the heat transfer is much more gentle, much less efficient. Sometimes inefficient heating is a good thing. And the great thing about the oven is that it heats the meat more gently and therefore doesn't end up overcooking the outside of the meat while the inside finishes cooking through.
And you can do it. I've only done it, frankly, I guess I've probably done it with other things and hadn't thought about that it's the same principle with chicken and other kinds of things. How did you get into the food writing business?
Completely by chance, and it's something I'm still thanking my lucky stars for. So I started out in school interested in science and studying astronomy. And after a few years of that at Caltech in Pasadena, I realized that what I was really interested in astronomy was not so much the computer calculations of planets and things like that, but the ideas and the fact that we live in this immense universe that we're only beginning to understand. So I switched from astronomy to philosophy and literature, did a graduate degree in literature, and then had trouble getting a good job teaching poetry.
Dang.
Yeah. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I can recoup my investment in science by coming at it from a different angle and writing about the science of everyday life. Astronomy was being covered by Stephen Hawking and, you know, people like that, so there was no point in my trying to get a toehold there. But nobody was writing about the science of cooking at the time. This is the late 70s. And so that's what I decided to do and discovered that no one had really done it. And beyond that, there was a growing interest in what's going on when we cook. And so it was kind of slow to begin with, but after a few years, I was able to make a living at it.
Were you a foodie?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I became a foodie in the process of writing the first edition of my book, the earlier book on food and cooking. I thought this is a great subject. I certainly loved to eat and was very interested in wine and enjoyed cooking. But, you know, I was a 20-something and had never gone to cooking school, so I really did learn on the job.
You've met some pretty amazing chefs along the way.
I have indeed, yes. That's been one of the wonderful and unexpected perks was that, back when I started, there was no such thing as an American-born chef. All the chefs that I met were trained in Europe and had come over here and had fancy restaurants. And boy, has the food world changed in the meantime. So I've met a bunch of wonderful American-born chefs, but also the chefs in Europe who are leading this kind of modern revolution in cooking that has in part to do with the use of science in the kitchen. It's been a lot of fun.
What differentiates chefs for you, the great ones? Are they both into the science and the art, or are they? How do they balance that sort of thing?
Well, I think you've put your finger on it exactly. There are a lot of cooks out there these days who see the prominence of the chefs who are using science in the kitchen, and so they focus on the science and on novelty and inventiveness without having the foundation in the artistry and in the craftsmanship. And for me, the chefs who are the really remarkable ones today are people who started out in developing the basics and coming up slowly and gradually and going to the meccas of great cooking like France and Italy and increasingly Japan and China, and getting to know what makes really good food really good. And then on that, you can build something new and interesting, but you have to have the foundation first.
What about this incredible proliferation of cooking shows? And not just watching, a chef cook and show something, but just everything about cooking, cupcakes, everything.
Yes.
I mean, there's going to be a show on sauces eventually. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And I think in a way it's a reflection of the fact that each of those subjects is a kind of world unto itself. I mean, you really can go on for hours and hours about cupcakes, which is kind of amazing. But I think a part of it is also the adaptation of the subject matter to the medium of television. So I used to watch these shows, as many of them as I possibly could, and I actually do that less nowadays because so often it's more about competition and a contest than it is about, and actually learning something new about that particular dish or a particular way of cooking. So I love the shows that do really teach you something, give you something that you can take with you into the kitchen and do yourself. But the show is about who's the best at making an imitation of a vending machine hot dog in in 10 minutes. That I'm less interested in.
We have to take a break. My guest is Harold McGee. He is the author of Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. He's also a New York Times columnist on cooking. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Nicole was a ninth grader then. By the end of her junior year, she had a full-blown heroin addiction, using mostly black tar heroin. She and her family, by most standards, live a middle-class life in a small suburban Columbus community.
The black tar is cheaper. You can get as much as you want and you can afford it.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides. 44 degrees with a chance of rain this afternoon, off and on, a high of 48 today. Rain showers are likely tonight, a low of 35 degrees. More rain expected for Tuesday with a high of 47. Rain again Tuesday night with a low of 43. And unfortunately, looks like rain again on Wednesday, and warmer still, a high of 55 degrees. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Harold McGee, and I don't think I've thoroughly discussed what a big shot Harold McGee is. He's the author of the award-winning classic on food and cooking, the science and lore of the kitchen. I mentioned earlier he writes the column for the New York Times, The Curious Cook. He has been named Food Writer of the Year by Bon Appetit magazine and one of the Time 100. That's an annual list of the world's most influential people. So here he is for us, all for us. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us on allsides@wosu.org, and we'd love to hear your questions or comments. I love it that you put the food volume conversions and weight conversions and all of that kind of stuff on the inside of the book. This is a classic reference book.
Well, that's what I was trying to write. Of course, only time will tell whether that's the case, but I really did want to make something that that was just a useful thing to have in anybody's kitchen, no matter how experienced you are. Maybe you're just starting out and you don't even know what a cup is. And so I thought having that kind of information immediately available would be a good thing.
Yeah, this is the kind of book that you expect there will be spills and stains and maybe even warping, like a few of mine are, from getting something poured on it accidentally. I think my what's the one by Ron Bauer?
The Joy of Cooking
is, yeah. Mine's completely warped. I can barely fit it into my bookcase anymore because I spilled something on it along the way. Who's the book aimed at, though?
Well, it's aimed in a way at I'll tell you who my imagined readers were,
yeah,
as I wrote it, and they were my children. So I have two kids. They're in their early 20s. They love food. They haven't had a lot of experience cooking it, but they're really interested in it, and they would call all the time with questions. I'm making this, I'm making that, what should I do here, what should I do there? If I'm shopping for a nice piece of meat, I don't have a lot of money, so how can I maximize my the chances of getting something good? And so they're the ones who I've actually had in mind throughout this, is people who love food, who are interested in food, but who don't necessarily have the background or the time to develop that kind of fingertip familiarity with cooking.
David from Newark, you're on the air with Harold McGee. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I think it's amazing that you put the contents on the outside of the book. That's really a stroke of genius.
Thank you.
Have you read the book yet?
No, I haven't. You know, I just found out about it. I'm driving right now, and I just found out about it when I turned on the radio. And I just think that's an amazing thing, because how many times you're in the kitchen and, well, if you're like me, I start to make something before I look up the recipe. And then halfway through it, I go, man, I really need a recipe for this. So my hands are already covered in something, flour or who knows what. And then I think, wow, you know, why didn't somebody think of that before?
You know, I look at what's in the fridge or what I have in my cupboards, and then I go look up something in the cookbooks that have the ingredients in it.
Yeah.
That's how I cook. Thanks, David, for your call.
Thank you.
How do you cook, Harold? Do you plan elaborate meals and go out and shop for them and bring it all back and do it?
Well, I sometimes do, and in fact, the last time I did was when both my kids were home for the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
But normally, I actually cook the way you do, the way you just described. I shop on the weekend. I go to a farmer's market if I can, and kind of load up on whatever looks good at that point in the season. And then Tuesday rolls along, and it's time to make something for dinner, and I look and see what I've got. And sometimes I look for a recipe, but sometimes I just go on what I've done in the past,
mm-hmm,
or something that I've experienced in a restaurant, and I try to make some kind of approximation of that. And that's another instance where I think knowing the principles of, for example, cooking meat so that you can kind of adapt from your own experience, your own tastes, and kind of make what you want. And the more you know about what you're doing, the easier that is.
You know, getting back to the contents of the book on the cover, it did raise some immediate questions for me. And one of them was, I was surprised that puddings were put in Chapter 14 with dried grains, pastas, and noodles.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that puddings are made, they're usually thickened with starch of one kind or another, and starch comes from dried grains. So the same principles that apply to the cooking of rice, for example, will apply to the cooking of puddings in general. And of course, rice pudding is a classic and a standard. So it's true that I could have put puddings into a sweets and dessert chapter because it also fits into those categories. But what I'm trying to help people do is, in their own minds, understand the basics of each different kind of preparation. And by understanding that puddings are thickened in the same way that a risotto is thickened, that'll help you understand what's going on and do it without great reliance on recipes.
And Kieran from Bexley, you're on the air with Harold McGee. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I had just had a question about a little bit cultural also about why in some cultures, you know, they'll like leave the butter out on the counter or never put baked goods in the refrigerator, and kind of wanted to know a little bit about the science of that. Like, is it fine to leave those things out? Is it fine to leave the butter out so it's soft and spreadable? I think in the United States, we tend to refrigerate almost everything. And I could take my answer off the air because I'm driving.
Thank you, Kieran.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And my grandparents on my mother's side were English. And so I would go to England in the summertime for a few weeks every year. And I noticed that right away, that my grandparents had a larder, a walk-in room, in which they kept all kinds of things, including leftovers. And that's because their refrigerator was big enough to hold a few bottles of milk and nothing else. So it's true that our standards for keeping foods and for kitchen hygiene in general have changed a lot over the last few decades. And it's a gray area. It's not black and white. So things like baked goods are dry enough that they don't really support the growth of harmful microbes. And so it's okay to keep bread in a bread box, for example. And butter, it turns out, doesn't have a whole lot of water in it either. And so it keeps reasonably well at room temperature. Although in the case of butter, the problem is not so much the butter getting dangerous, it's the butter getting rancid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the flavor goes off and it'll keep much better and longer at cold temperatures. So it really is a fascinating area where different countries, different people will do very different things. They're all safe, but you end up with slightly different results.
You devote an entire and detailed chapter to food safety, the cooking, serving, and also maximizing safety for vulnerable people. What's that about?
Well, so food safety is, as I said, this gray area where in order to make all of our food absolutely safe and risk-free, we'd essentially have to autoclave it, to cook it, pressure cook it for an hour or two. And then everything would be completely safe, at least the moment it came out of the pressure cooker. But of course, it would all taste awful. So we're always making compromises between deliciousness and safety. And where you come down on that spectrum depends on, I think it needs to depend on who you're cooking for. And if you're a 20-something and you're healthy and you can take anything, you might go ahead and have raw oysters, for example. And if you got sick, well, you chalk it up to experience and that those oysters were delicious. Maybe it was worth it. But if you're older, if you are dealing with some kind of chronic illness, or if you're a pregnant woman or nursing, then you want to think twice about things like that and maybe make a different decision. And so what I try to do in that chapter is lay out the basics of food safety so that people can decide for themselves what sorts of risks they want to take and what kinds of insurance they want to take out on a particular meal.
You know, in addition to that, I noticed in the meat chapter that you also have a section on leftovers, just of meat.
Yes, and it seems to me that that's one of the areas where we often don't think so much about safety. Mm-hmm. We think, you know, we buy something raw from the supermarket, and yeah, there's an issue about making that safe. But then we have this feeling that once we've cooked something, we're okay. And it turns out that the moment that you finish cooking something and take it out of the oven or out of the frying pan and put it at room temperature on a serving platter, microbes from the air colonize that food, and some microbes actually survive the cooking process. And they absolutely love warm temperatures, serving temperatures. And if you kind of forget about that and say you're at Thanksgiving or Christmas time and you leave the food out for hours and hours while you're having a good time sitting and chatting and having an extra glass of wine, those leftovers can turn out to be not so good for you. So keeping that in mind and making sure that you get leftovers into the fridge quickly after dinner and that you warm them up to the temperature that will, again, kill microbes before you serve them the next time. That's what I tried to give information for in the chapter.
Rod from Columbus, you're on the air with Harold McGee. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I had kind of a wild idea. You know, I was watching one of the food programs that featured a Chinese chef. I can't remember his name right now, but he was preparing a dish where he was chopping up some beef, and what he ended up with looked a lot like hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of wondering, you know, just, you know, with these various cuisines, and I also recall a article in Playboy about how to make the perfect hamburger or whatever. Basically I was wondering, you know, what what could be done, you know, what these various chefs would do with you know, the classic American meal of hamburger, fries, and a shake.
Yeah, that's it's a good question, and in fact, that's one of the wonderful things about the food world these days. When I started writing about food in the 70s, nobody messed with those things. They just were what they were, and people weren't that inventive. Nowadays, you go to some restaurants in New York, for example, and they'll have their own house version of a hamburger that involves an outer layer of ground beef, but then inside there's short ribs, there's steak, there's all kinds of stuff, it's just wonderful to see the imagination opening for these dishes that we used to think of as very straightforward pedestrian things, but they can really be interesting.
Thanks, Rod, for your call.
Thank you.
We have an email from Debbie. She says, I used to sell on food and cooking as a sales rep at Scribner's way back in the 1980s, so I'm a real fan of Mr. McGee. What is his opinion of chefs like, and I hope I don't butcher this, Ferran Adria, especially regarding creations like foams and liquid nitrogen-created foods?
Ferran Adria is one of those people I was describing earlier who started out life as a cook focused on the basics, who then had this kind of revelation in the late 1980s that what he was essentially doing all his career was cooking what other people told him to cook. And so he realized that he could do something that hadn't been done before by, instead of meeting people's expectations for a particular kind of dish, you know, a pasta dish or a meat dish or something like that, he could actually spend his time trying to imagine dishes that no one else had imagined and then completely confound your expectations. So give you things that you would never have known you could even have. And I would say that he's one of the people who is a certifiable genius at that. He's widely recognized as the man who put that kind of cooking on the map, and it's partly because he did it so well. If he'd had that idea and then had not been so good at the execution, then I don't think we would have the kind of inventive cooking that we have today. So I think he's the real deal.
And then there are the imitators and the copiers, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I would say that each country, as far as I can tell, has maybe a handful of people who are working at his level and making really interesting, unusual, and delicious things. Then there are a lot of other people who are making very unusual and interesting, but often not so delicious things.
They look cool, though. This is an email from Dina. She writes, can he recommend a good source about the do's and don'ts about using spices in my cooking, such as what adds to the flavor or, say, meat or fish, vegetables, or what spices don't work with, say, meat or fish or vegetables? I hate to buy spices just to try something out because if I don't like it, I've just wasted my money and the spice.
Yeah. Well, I would say two things. I can recommend a book, but before I do that, I just want to say that flavor is one of the most subjective things about cooking that there is. Different people experience foods very differently because we have different senses of taste and smell, and this is something that's becoming more and more evident the more we learn about the human body and the human genome. We just live in different universes when it comes to the experience we have of exactly the same foods. And we have different preferences based on our childhood and what we're used to, what kind of tolerance we have for new experiences. All that being said, there is a book called The Flavor Bible, which does, I think, exactly what the caller is asking. It pulls chefs from restaurants all over the world and asks them what kinds of combinations of flavors work in your experience. And it kind of condenses all that information and makes it usable. So you'll find lots of ideas in there. For example, if you're interested in making a fish dish and you want to give it an unusual flavor, you can go to that chapter and read about the kinds of things that people have found to work in this country and in other countries as well.
I one of the food competition shows once watched them compete over having to decide what the smells or what the spices were. They were blindfolded,
uh-huh.
And I not only was amazed at how accurate some of these people were, amazingly accurate, but I was also felt sort of bad for the people who did just bombed it, totally bombed it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in fact, flavor is the subject of the next book I'm writing because it is such a fascinating subject. It's where we get the most of the pleasure of food, of course, is from flavor. And you're absolutely right. You know, it's one thing to sit down to a meal and to be able to look at things and say, yeah, that's a wonderful red sauce or a perfectly cooked piece of beef. But then you blindfold people and put things in their mouths and say, what's that? If you're deprived of the visual input, it can be really hard. I've done that kind of thing myself, and there are times when you know that you're familiar with the flavor. You know you've had it a million times, but without that other information, you just can't put a name to it. So it's fascinating the way the mind works that way.
We're going to have to take another break. My guest is Harold McGee. He's the author of a new book. It's called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. He co-wrote the music for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Last year, he won an Oscar for the score for The Social Network. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Time is running out for you to make your 2011 contribution to our station. Our goal is to raise an additional $50,000 by December 31st. Pledge at WOSU.org/2011 or by phone at 866-897-9678. Your gift is tax deductible and supports the programming on 89.7 NPR News. Happy holidays and Happy New Year from WOSU Public Media, and thank you for your support of the programming on 89.7 FM. There is a chance of rain today, some isolated showers this afternoon, a high of 48 degrees, more rain for tonight, and a low of 35. Looking ahead to Tuesday, rain unfortunately throughout the day and a high of 47, and rain still on Wednesday, even warmer with a high of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Harold McGee. He is the author of the award-winning classic on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. He also writes a column, Curious Cook, for the New York Times. We're talking today about his newest book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. We have an email from Dan in Grandview Heights. He starts us out. Maybe this is too basic a question for your guest, but nothing's too basic, right?
No, not at all.
Okay. What's the trick to frying in stainless steel? My wife and I like to use our stainless steel pans for vegetables, eggs, and tofu, but too often we find items stuck to the pan with a horrible cleanup chore. What are we doing wrong?
You're not doing anything wrong. You're just experiencing the downside of stainless steel, which is that it's great for certain things, but not for other things. And it is true that foods tend to stick to the surface of stainless steel utensils. So there are a couple of things you can do to minimize that problem, if not avoid it altogether. One of them is actually to fry in a little bit of butter rather than oil. And that's because it turns out that butter has a natural version of what's in the anti-stick sprays that you can also buy and use. And there's just enough of it in there that it'll make things stick much less if you simply replace a cooking oil with butter. Now, you may not want to use butter for other reasons, flavor or because butter has a fair amount of saturated fat. If that's the case, then actually using one of these nonstick sprays is a good alternative because it contains a fair amount of these nonstick materials kind of concentrated in oil rather than butter. The thing, though, is to remember with either one of them that the nonstick molecules make the oil and foods scorch at lower temperatures than just using plain oil. So you need to be a little more careful with the frying temperature, but they'll both work.
Now, with my nonstick, a lot of stuff I don't like to fry in that because it doesn't leave me those little bits behind that you want to do when you want to make that sauce.
Exactly. If you use a nonstick pan, then you don't have the sticking problem, but you also don't end up with that wonderful pan residue mm-hmm. that then allows you to make a little sauce by dissolving them off the bottom. So another thing to mention, if you do want to go ahead and use a stainless pan and you do end up with some sticking, another thing you can do to help yourself out is not to try to turn the food too quickly. So watch that residue developing and wait for it to get nice and brown. And that's actually a signal that you've formed a good crust on the food, and it's then going to detach from the surface more easily than it would otherwise.
Christina, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just recently had a dish in my hometown of Rockford, Illinois, which was a white chocolate sauce on a sea bass. And it was absolutely amazing.
How does that happen, Harold?
Well, that's part of that 21st century who'da thunk it mentality with cooks, you know, who are now interested in trying things to do exactly that, to surprise you with how wonderful something is, and you never would have dreamed it.
Christina, you're breaking up. I'm sorry to say we can't hear you, but you're saying, I think you were saying it wasn't as sweet as you thought it would be.
Right, it was more savory.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's something that you can actually work with both white and dark chocolate. There's going to be some sugar in there, but you can always balance it with other things, with a little bit of acidity, for example, a little bit of citrus juice or a vinegar. In fact, there's a classic French sauce that's made of nothing but vinegar and sugar. So it's a sweet sauce, but the vinegar makes it sweet and sour, and the overall effect is a savory one. So there are all kinds of things like that that are making cooking a lot more fun and interesting than it used to be.
Thanks, Christina.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
You know, I put cooking chocolate, it's bittersweet at most, in my chili now.
Uh-huh.
I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, the thing about chocolate, dark chocolate, mm-hmm. Not so much white chocolate, but dark chocolate is made from roasted seeds, and roasting produces a kind of characteristic, rich, deep flavor that, of course, we find in many savory foods. And so using a little bit of chocolate to deepen the flavor of sauces of all kinds is a wonderful idea.
You know, surprised me, and I haven't tried it yet. I want to make sure I do soon. Preheating flour.
Yes.
Tell me about that. That's interesting. I can't wait to try it.
Yeah. Well, that's, in fact, the same basic idea. Flour is the essentially ground up raw wheat berries. Whole wheat with the husk, white flour without the husk, but it's essentially raw seeds. And if you just simply take the trouble to spread the flour out, measure it out first, and then spread it out on a baking sheet and put it in the oven and toast it for a little bit, you end up developing a flavor in it that it would never have otherwise. Now, that doesn't work if you're going to make, for example, a loaf of bread, where that toasting process can change the proteins in a way that makes it not ideal for developing gluten in a bread. But if you're going to make pasta with it or thicken a sauce with it, it's a wonderful trick.
We had a caller, as a matter of fact, who wanted you to describe making a roux. Would you do that? Would you do that with the flour before that?
Well, in fact, making a roux is essentially that process,
okay.
Except you do it on the stovetop. So you make a roux by taking butter or oil and putting some flour into that in a saucepan, and then turning on the heat and stirring the flour until it develops a pretty color and a wonderful toasty aroma. And you can do that until the flour is kind of a pale blonde color, or you can do it until it looks as though it's like chocolate, and get that whole range of flavors depending on what you're looking for.
Roxy, you're on the show. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, Christina's question was very similar to mine, but I do have a second question. I love a good, like a pot roast. I guess it's actually braised with some juice around it,
mm-hmm.
Or a pork shoulder or what have you. But when I go to reheat them, the flavor is always different, and I don't know if that's a factor of being, you know, kept on the bone, if I should remove a bone, or, certainly I try to avoid microwaving it and maybe warm it up in a skillet. Just thoughts on how I can't get that original flavor back.
Yeah. So actually, I wouldn't dismiss the idea of reheating in a microwave, because the thing about reheating in a microwave carefully at low power is that you actually cook the food, whatever it is, more evenly than you can in a saucepan on the top of the stove, where you're only really heating one side at a time. But the thing about leftover meats, and especially pork and poultry, is what in the food industry is known as WOF, warmed over flavor. and it's just a kind of inevitable result of cooking something and then reheating it, and you end up with a different set of flavors than you did to begin with. Best way to avoid warmed over flavor is actually just to let the food warm up to room temperature and serve it cool, not actually reheat it at all. That way you avoid that.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Roxy. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and speak with Harold McGee, New York Times columnist and author of Keys to Good Cooking. can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. You devote a whole chapter to dairy. I think it's dairy and eggs. No, it's not dairy and eggs. It's dairy and dairy, maybe.
Yeah, just dairy.
Just dairy. There's a big debate. A lot of people wonder about the organic products, if they're worth the money to buy organic milk, for instance.
Yeah. So I would say that it's really important these days, especially, to think about where our foods come from and the kinds of choices that we're making, whether we do so consciously or not, when we buy particular kinds of ingredients, particular kinds of products. And in the case of organics, there are several different factors involved. One is the production system, the kind of agriculture that's being practiced and how sustainable that is. Another is health, the issue of pesticide residues and higher or lower nutrient levels in the food. And then last of all is flavor. Does it taste better? And those are each of those is a separate issue. And sometimes the conventional product will end up being better, apparently, than the organic, and sometimes the other way around. So what you need to do as a consumer is decide what's most important to you, and then look at the particular product that you're interested in and see what we know about it. We're still learning about such things, for example, as nutritional value. There's always going to be new information about it. So, but it's a wonderful thing to be aware of these issues and to make the best choices for you and your family.
We have an email from Paul. He writes, I really like your book on food and cooking, which has been a reference for me several times. It has good tips for repairing a recipe that didn't turn out quite like I wanted. The chemistry and applications are most educational. Perhaps you can elaborate on the use of copper bowls and utensils.
So copper is something that we don't see that much in kitchens these days, especially these days. It used to be much more common. Mm-hmm. But copper can be useful in certain preparations. The reason we don't see it so much is actually twofold. One is that copper has become really expensive. It's used so much in electronics, in wires, transmission wires that carry electricity from one place to another in the world, that it's just become a very expensive metal. It's also reactive. So when we cook in it, if we cook, say, an acidic food, we'll end up with a residue of copper in the food, and it makes the food taste metallic, mm-hmm. And that's not so desirable. But there are a couple of things that copper is really good at. One is transmitting heat. It's a very good conductor, and so pans that are made from a base of copper, but
like Revereware, that kind of thing?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Coated with stainless or with something nonstick, that's a wonderful combination. And the other thing is that a copper bowl is a great kind of bowl in which to make an egg white foam for meringues or souffles. Turns out that the copper does things to the proteins in the egg whites that are beneficial.
But it doesn't give you the aftertaste?
You can taste it in the raw eggs, but then by the time you end up making the meringue or the souffle, there are enough other ingredients in there that you don't notice.
Doug from Springfield, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you mentioned microwave ovens. Bane with me is it ruins bread. What do you think?
Well, there are certain things for which microwaves are really not suited, and breads and cakes and cookies and baked goods in general are the biggest category. But when it comes to, for example, cooking vegetables or cooking fish, it can be a really wonderful tool.
I agree. It's just everywhere I go, people put bread in the microwave, and I hate that.
It makes it mushy.
Yeah, exactly. And stale. It tastes stale.
Yeah. No, you want dry heat when you're making baked goods of any kind, unless it's a steamed bun or something like that. But that's a completely different category.
Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
We just have a few minutes left with our guest, Harold McGee, New York Times columnist and author of his new book, which is what we're talking about right now, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. I have an email from Bob in Columbus. Mr. McGee, your book sounds like what I need. I've always found it insufferably rude when I've looked through the cabinets and declared there to be no food in the house, only to have someone else go right behind me and seemingly concoct a delicious three-course meal out of milk, chicken broth, and a can of old breadcrumbs. I just can't seem to get that ability to cook delicious meals without recipes.
Well, I think the best way to get to that stage of being able to whip something up like that is simply to think of cooking as recreation and a kind of like solving a puzzle, you know, putting a jigsaw puzzle together. Dismiss any thoughts of comparing yourself with other people or worrying about anything in particular, and just look at it as a kind of fun exercise. What can I do with what I've got here? And if there's someone behind you who's good at that, then spend a couple of days with them in the kitchen, just asking them how they think. Where did they come up with that idea? And I hope it'll become as much fun for you as it is for them.
Harold, is there anything you left out that you could kick yourself for now?
So far, I have not come across something like that, although people have pointed out a couple of typos that I should have caught, and I'm kicking myself about those.
I haven't found any myself, but now I have a new goal. You know, one other thing, we only have a couple minutes left, but the benefits of water, a column of yours from July, I've talked about that, and I tried it with my coffee. I've diluted my coffee a little bit, and it's better.
Yeah. It's, one of the things that's been taken for granted these days is that intensity of flavor is the best thing. And so we want things more concentrated. And it turns out that the more some things get concentrated, actually the less flavor we can enjoy in them. We get kind of overloaded. And if you dilute certain things like coffee, like tea, cocktails, like wines that are often 15% and way too strong, if we just add a little bit of water to some of those things, it can end up making them much more delicious.
Well, that was something new I learned, and I appreciated it. I recommend the Curious Cook column in the New York Times to anybody. Our guest today, Harold McGee, New York Times columnist of said column, and also authors of Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Harold, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ann. I had a lot of fun.
That's all the time we have for All Sides. Thanks to you out there for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 89.7 and 820. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.